Welcome to the Boston College Chief Executives Club podcast of the February 15th forum featuring AT&T Chairman, CEO, and President Randall Stephenson. I'm Warren Zola. The Boston College Chief Executives Club, a program of the Carroll School of Management, is one of the top-ranked CEO speaking forums in the world. Several times each year, Boston's business leaders gather to learn from CEOs of global companies, leaders from the top echelons of their fields who welcome the opportunity to address an audience of their peers. Mr. Stephenson engaged in a fireside chat with Abby Johnson, Chairman and CEO of Fidelity Investments. The conversation touched on a variety of subjects, including net neutrality, 5G, and AT&T's efforts to merge with Time Warner. Please enjoy this podcast of the Boston College Chief Executives Club.
Great. Well, Randall, it's great to see you.
Thank you, Abby. Good to see you. Good to be in Boston.
Yeah. Well, since it's just the two of us here chatting, and I'm not sure anybody else is really listening, I've been wondering, how's this acquisition thing going? What's happening with Time Warner? I mean,
that acquisition.
Yeah, that okay. One. I know you've had a lot over the years, and I've had the opportunity to chat with you about them from time to time, but this is the one that's on the burner right now.
We've hit a little speed bump, but as you heard discussed in the opening, we're trying to acquire Time Warner, and they are the parent company of Warner Brothers Studios and HBO and Turner Network, so CNN and TBS, TNT, and so forth. And we really thought it'd be a good idea. We've been working over the last few years to build the capability to distribute video, premium video, over wireless technology, and we're investing a lot. Warren, you say $200 billion? I knew our guys were investing too much, but we've been investing a lot to make this happen. And as we think about building out these kind of capabilities, invariably we will build out these kind of capabilities and somebody will make a lot of money to, you know, taking advantage of these capabilities. Apple did quite well off the mobile internet when we made the internet mobile, right? And the iPhone came along. And we really believed as you begin to build the capability to distribute premium video and people will consume premium video, there's going to be a whole new distribution avenue for media companies. And we were kind of the naysayers that media companies were in decline. We actually thought if you create this kind of distribution, media companies will probably become more valuable over time. And we thought we should own some premium video. And so we worked with Time Warner. Jeff Bukas and I reached an agreement to acquire it. And I won't go into the legal dogma, but it was a vertical merger. And we looked at this, and no competitors would be taken out of the market. And we did our analysis. And for 50 years, there has not been one of these really challenged and successfully challenged in the courts. And so we entered into the deal, and after a year of review, the United States government decided that this had antitrust. They contend that it has antitrust implications. And so they have filed to sue AT&T and Time Warner to block the merger. And so we are in the middle of that process, and we have a court date set for March 19th. And judge has been selected. We're in the D.C. Circuit Court, and we'll be going to trial on March 19th. And the government will have to put on their case. And that's the interesting part about a vertical merger. Burden of proof is on the government. They will have to demonstrate in a court of law that this does have antitrust implications and will substantially reduce competition and increase prices. And so the burden of proof is on them. And so we'll be defending that 3-week trial, and hopefully we'll get a verdict and an order late in the spring.
Randall, I've never seen anyone say, and we're going to court with a big smile on their face.
One learns to force things when you're in this kind of situation, right?
And what makes you say that?
Actually, we do feel good about our case for all the reasons I said. And you've probably been reading a lot in the papers over the last few days about some of the court maneuvering that's going on, and there are a lot, there's a lot of noise around this particular deal. As you probably know, we announced this deal back in the fall of 2016, and shortly thereafter, Megan Delrahim was a professor at Pepperdine University, and he was asked in the media his views of the deal, and he clearly articulated that it'd probably get a close review. It's a big deal. He did say to get a close review, but he didn't see any antitrust issues with it. And then you probably saw the president is not the biggest fan of CNN and expressed his objections to the deal very publicly. Said it was the kind of deal his administration would not approve. And then the Pepperdine University professor, Mr. Del Rahim, was then hired into the White House after President Trump was put in office to work as his counsel for a few months, and then was nominated to run the antitrust division, was confirmed, and came out after his confirmation and promptly filed suit to block the deal. And so, I have said that's an elephant in the room, and it's probably going to have to be dealt with in some context. So that's kind of where we are, and you've been reading about that in the papers over the last few days.
So someone's going to write a book about this.
Somebody probably will. It won't be me. I'm not doing a book. Yeah.
So let's talk about a few other things that you've been working on. One of the big things that AT&T has been working on and that you're now, I think, ready to deliver is that came out of 9/11, FirstNet, mm-hmm. which is a completely new thing, something that will potentially change all of our lives in terms of being able to respond in emergencies. Tell us about the background and how that developed and what it's going to look like and feel like when it's gone.
This is a big deal. I was referring to FirstNet, which is for first responder network is what it's representing. And as Abby said, after 9/11, you recall what happened in Manhattan or in downtown in New York. EMS, fire department, police were all coming in and converging, and it was a crisis and it was chaos, and none of the first responders could communicate with each other. They could all communicate with themselves, but not with each other, and it was a bad situation. And other first responders from other communities came in to try to assist, and there was just no way for the agencies to interact with each other and to communicate by radio and so forth. And so legislation was passed that said we need to deal with this as a country. And our first responders need to have a network that is interoperable. They can all talk to each other. And firefighters from New York can communicate with firefighters in Boston if there's a big disaster. And the police can communicate with the firefighters and EMS and so forth. And so legislation was passed for the government to contract to build a network for first responders, a wireless network for first responders. And so it's been a number of years. A lot transpired, and ultimately the government did something. They auctioned off a big block of wireless airwaves back in, I think it was 2014. This was smart, and I think this is actually going to prove to be a model around the world for how you deal with these kind of communication needs. But they auctioned off a lot of these airwaves. We were the largest bidder. We spent a lot of money, billions and billions of dollars, over $10 billion in that auction. And of the money the government received in that auction, we actually spent $18 billion, it was in the public domain, so we spent $18 billion. The government carved out $6.5 billion of that money from that auction, and they had another block of these airwaves, and they said, everybody come in and bid. Who wants to build out this nationwide network for the first responder community? And whoever wins the bid will get this spectrum to build that network in. So it's dedicated for our first responder community, and the government will put the first $6.5 billion forward to build this network. And AT&T, we went hard after this. This became a must-win for AT&T. This is something we wanted to do. We thought it was just a big thing to do with the country, a public-private partnership of scale, like I don't think we've seen in this country for a long time. We bid to spend $40 billion to build out this network, and we won it. We won it last year. And so we have a number of years to get this network built, but it requires us to cover the entire country with high-speed wireless capability. And that's really great for first responders, and I'm excited about that. But it also is a big deal for our rural communities, because we are now building out mobile broadband capability that will cover the entire United States. It's going to be a very pervasive build. And where we build this network, here in Boston and down in Florida particularly, it will be what we call a hard network. It's going to have bunkering. It's going to have serious backup power to all these cell sites and so forth to withstand hurricanes, flooding, et cetera. Like this, after this past year, you saw the importance of having that kind of hardening of these networks that can withstand serious natural disasters and man-made disasters as well. And so we won this. The other thing about it is, as we go around building this network, you've probably heard a lot about 5G technology, fifth generation technology. This is taking the wireless service that you have now and putting it on steroids. This is game-changing technology. As we're building this network, we'll be equipping all of our cell sites around the country for this next wave of technology. And so it's going to help accelerate a new wave of technology that is, this is as much game-changing technology as anything I've been a part of in my career, and I've been doing this 35 years. And so there's just a very natural additive effect. First responders, check. They're going to have a very beautiful wireless network capability, interoperable and so forth. Rural America, check. Accelerate the provisioning of fifth-generation wireless technology, check. It just has a number of elements and touch points that I think are really good for America, we think it's good for AT&T as well.
So that next G, we went from 3G to 4G, and I hear people saying, well, 5G, I mean, how many Gs are we going to have? I mean, and what does that fifth G really mean for people who are your regular mobile phone users?
So 5G, most people, they hear 5G, they say, well, so it'll just be even faster than 4G. It will be. It will be faster. But the speed is not what's so important. It's latency. And if you don't know what latency is, it's the moment you push the button or the moment you request information or the moment you try to transact in a mobile world, how long does it take for that to happen? And you try to download a video. You know, you've seen how long that can take. With 5G, latency by and large goes away. It becomes instantaneous. And instantaneous is really important as you start to think about things beyond surfing the web and email and watching your favorite movie, Game of Thrones or CNN. As you begin to think things beyond that, consider autonomous cars. And I happen to be a big believer that we will experience and live in a world with autonomous cars, cars without drivers. Now, that requires extensive networking capability. The automobiles need to know where other automobiles are. They need to know where the traffic is. They need to know if there are people or elements coming out in the road in front of the automobile. I don't know about you, but if I'm going to be in one of these, I suddenly will get my head around what latency means. Because you cannot live in a world like that where an automobile is driving itself and have latency. This is why 5G is so important. It takes latency out of the game. Internet of Things, all the connected devices we think of that are driving anything from manufacturing processes. Think about manufacturing. If you need to have a high-speed drill turn off for safety reasons, you cannot afford latency. Think about the world of virtual and augmented reality. This is where latency and these kind of services become really, really critical. And so just like 3G really open the world for things like the iPhone and smartphone technology, 5G is going to open the door for a whole new range of services, technologies, capabilities like autonomous cars. And so I'm probably as enthusiastic about this technological move as anything I've been a part of.
Well, many of us here in the room are part of the extended financial services industry, and
you know latency.
Various, latency is a pretty big deal to us.
Yeah.
So it sounds like we can start to let our imaginations run a little crazier than we have in the past around what we might be able to do for ourselves and our own operations, as well as what we might be able to do for some of our customers with the help of this technology.
High-speed trading could go to locations and geographies we might not have ever conceived of before.
Yeah, so when do we get it?
So we have announced that we will be doing the first deployment of mobile 5G. Some of the early deployments we're all playing around with of 5G are just, it's a broadband replacement to your home, okay? Mm-hmm. That's great. And to think about, you can have a wireless broadband service to your home that gives you a gig speeds of service is a big, big deal. And we will all be pursuing that. It's going to change the competitive game. Think about cable operators. I mean, this is a new competitive opportunity against cable operators. Pervasive, wireless, fed home broadband. But mobile, this capability in a mobile environment, that's the, in our view, that's the secret sauce. And so we will be deploying in 12 cities this year, the mobile version of 5G. And we have secured the spectrum, these airwaves. This will operate in a different set of airwaves that we're accustomed to. And without getting technical, these smartphones that we're all using, if you think about, they're operating, if you stack the airwaves that we're using right now, your mobile phone today operates in the airwaves that kind of range from the floor to about my hand. 5G is going to operate in frequencies that are at the top of your building at Fidelity, okay? It's in a whole different stratosphere. And that's what gives you these much higher speeds and lower latency. And so the spectrum has been secured, and now we're just building out the networks. And so you'll begin to see it turn up this year. And between now and 2021, it's going to become, I think, very prolific.
Yeah, be exciting.
It will be. I think it's going to be a game changer. It will change. I venture to say, I'm looking at the people in this room and all the industries represented here, there will not be an industry untouched by this.
So everybody will be able to take advantage of this.
It'll
be great.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And every time we conceive of new levels of bandwidth, as we like to call it in our industry, you know, higher speed internet, higher speed data transmission, you know, you always say, what's going to use that? Invariably, you know, we find the far extreme uses of this in a very quick period of time. It'll be the same with this.
Yeah. So one area that has been controversial, but now for the time being has been settled, has been the debate over net neutrality. And that was something that was debated, deliberated. We've now moved into a different world. Can you give us the background on how that evolution has gone and how you've thought about it?
Yeah, net neutrality. I suspect if I asked at random 10 people in this room what it was, I'd get 10 different answers. And so I always like to try to put it in context as we're talking about it. I think what most people would say when they talk about net neutrality, what they're representing is that the idea that whatever content I want to get to on my smartphone or on the internet, I ought to be able to get to it. And nobody ought to be a gatekeeper for that. So don't block my content. That's one, number one. And number two, depending on the content I go to, nobody should be dictating how quickly I can get to it, how fast it gets to me. Throttling is the term. So blocking and throttling, those are the kind of the two big things people talk about. And so this has been the biggest debate in our industry that I can recall. And the rules have, one FCC comes in and says, here are the rules. New president comes in, appoints a new FCC chairman. They say, no, the rules are over here. Then somebody comes in and files a lawsuit, and the courts come in and say, nope, needs to be back over here. Then a new FCC commissioner comes in and says, no, but if we do it this way, then we can get the rules back over here. We're all in the industry just going, I'm getting dizzy, all right? I don't even know how to invest here. And what has happened is the FCC came along in 2015, and put... They used an approach that would withstand court challenge, they believed. We'll see if that turns out to be the case or not. But they used an approach that said, we're going to take rules that were written in the 1930s that gives the FCC the authority to do what this particular FCC was trying to do. Some old rules, they were rules written for the black dial telephone, seriously, in the 1930s. They said, let's just take that regime and put on top of the internet and wireless technology. Now, while I'm not suggesting that was the FCC's intent, what the FCC now has the authority to do was they could regulate every facet of wireless and the internet. That seemed like a really bad idea to us. And so a new FCC comes in and says, nah, doesn't work, and they took that off. And so now people are saying net neutrality is gone. And I had a woman come up to me, I was in New York, and she was 30-something years old, And she asked, are you familiar with this net neutrality thing? I'm kind of familiar with it. And she said, I'm scared to death. And I said, what are you afraid of? That it's going to go away. And I said, and then what? What is it that frightens you? She said, I don't know. Can you tell me? And I said, nothing. Nothing will happen. What the FCC has done is basically said, look, AT&T, you have in your customer terms and services and conditions that you will not throttle and you will not block. You're legally bound to that, and we will hold you to that, all right? The FTC now has authority over that. And so what's happened, though, is that's this one FCC now is taking the rules here. I lay awake at night and say, you know, if the Democratic Party wins in 2020, and a new FCC commissioner comes in, does he want them back over here? And so we're going to be in this game until Congress does its job. And my belief is Congress needs to step up, and they need to take this issue on comprehensively. Thou shalt not block, thou shalt not throttle, according to statutes written by Congress. And by the way, while you're at it, you need to talk about privacy. What can companies do with customer data? What can all companies, not just ours, but all companies, what can they do with the customer data? What are the rules of the road around privacy and customer privacy? Just take all of this on. Let's get one set of rules. Let's turn the industry loose and say, now that we have stability, we have predictability, go after it, let's get after it. So our position has always been one, no throttling, no blocking, and let's get the rules right on privacy, and you'll see investment flourish. But a world where we're just sitting here pivoting back and forth playing ping pong with really major implications to industry, I think is just not wise for us as a country on something this important. So we're pushing hard to get Congress to do something.
It would be great to get a lot of things settled in Congress. Couldn't agree more. And the data privacy one is very interesting. Certainly from my perspective in our industry, it's a very big deal. You know, we see some of the European regulators challenging it, which is kind of interesting to watch. And you wonder how long it'll take to drift over here, if ever. But what does all of this mean for the enterprise that you've been working on around analytics and the marketing and what you could use, some of the information that you're gaining from all of this?
Yeah, so it's a good point. As you think about the business we have built and the business we're trying to build if we get through this lawsuit, we have a lot of interesting customer insights. We have the largest pay TV business in the United States, and we have 140 million customers in North America with cell phones, smartphones, and so forth. And there's a lot of interesting customer insights attached to all that. We know what our customers are watching. We know what they like to watch. We know when they like to watch it. And we know where they are when they like to watch certain things because they're now watching it on these mobile devices. So getting the privacy rules is right. We want our customers to have confidence so we're not using their information in ways that they haven't given us permission to use that information. But as you think then about owning a media company, why are media companies, why have their valuations been stressed of late? And it gets back to a core issue. Media companies, at least the older media companies, set Netflix and Google and Amazon aside for a moment, but media companies don't know who their end user customers are. They have no relationship with them. They don't know what they're watching. They don't know when they're watching it and where they are when they're watching it. This is just, they're selling their content to others who then distribute to their customers. DirecTV, we own a DirecTV. We know who's watching TNT, when they're watching, etc. Time Warner does not know that. So think about pairing distribution with the media. And the media companies are in decline because they don't know who is watching their content, and as a result, what's happening to advertising revenues. People are saying it's too expensive, and we don't have any way to target the advertising, so they're going to Google, they're going to Facebook, and as a result, you look at the advertising industry, roughly 100% of all advertising growth is those two companies. And while traditional media advertising is in decline, we actually happen to think that if one could pair the knowledge of the customer that a distribution company has with a media company, you could drive a lot of value to a media company. We actually think this is a very powerful opportunity. I'll give you a little example of how powerful we think this is. In DirecTV, when we distribute CNN to our customers. There are 16 minutes of commercials in every hour on CNN. As part of the arrangement, we get 2 minutes of that advertising. CNN gets the other 14 minutes. Our 2 minutes, we go to market and we sell to advertisers with the information that we have. So we have the mobile data, we have the viewership data, we have all that information. Where we use that information and go to advertisers, advertisers are paying us something in the order of $30 per impression. That's about what they pay us. You go to Turner Networks and Time Warner, advertisers are paying them about $8 per impression. Now, you say, well, why are advertisers paying you so much more? They're probably paying us less. They're just paying us higher per CPM because we're getting it only to the people that want to see their advertising that finds it relevant. So we can get really targeted with the advertising, whereas media companies are struggling to do this. And this is one of the biggest benefits, synergies, of the Time Warner deal is getting to where we can actually target all of their, they've got a ton of advertising inventory. We want to use this data and analytics to target their advertising to it only gets to people who would be interested in seeing that advertising. And I'm actually convinced that if we're as successful as we believe we will be, we think 16 minutes of advertising may be too much. Can you then, if you can get the yields higher, can you drive the advertising load down and can you make the consumer experience actually better? Less advertising load and actually kind of drive benefits to the consumer that way.
Yeah, so I think I heard you say you're going to take about 60% off of Fidelity's ad budget.
That's a good target. I'll work towards it, okay?
So let me ask one more question before we open it up to the audience here. So what you've described is an incredible transformation of a huge company. So you've changed so much of the work that's going on, how you work. There's tremendous amounts of software that goes into being developed to make all of this happen once these new business directions have been set. That's a very different kind of workforce than the, albeit always technical, kind of workforce that AT&T would have had. Can you talk about the workforce culture that you're trying to drive at the organization and some of the things that you've done specifically to try to shape the culture and the feel of the workforce to be one that is more welcoming and more attractive to that kind of talent that you need for the future?
Yeah, I've lost track of time. It had to be 6 or 7 years ago now. We were looking at the transformation that was going on inside our company and how technology was changing. And we're going from, you know, you come in and you drop a big box that handles all the various networking functions in it. And you have people who know how to go in and do that and how to run that kind of network. And, you know, we have 140,000, 150,000 people who run the network and the IT side of all of this. And we're moving to a world where it's less about all that hardware, it's about software that's driving all of this. And you're kind of taking the hardware down to commodity layers, and all of the intelligence and all the skill is in the software. And this is happening really fast. And 5 or 6 or 7 years ago, we were looking at this, and this is exciting. This is great. It's going to require a lot fewer people to run this kind of network. And so as we looked at how that was going to phase out over time, we said the good news was, you know, we tend to have a workforce in our telecommunications business that is aging. And so there was just a natural attrition that was going to accommodate that downsizing was going to need to occur. The problem was, you looked at the people that were remaining that were going to have to run this thing, and they didn't have the skill sets for the new world, software-centric skill sets. And we looked at this. This became, at that moment in time for me, one of the most complex logistical issues I had addressed as CEO. And you know, we face a lot of complex logistical issues. Building out a FirstNet, right? First responder network. That's a huge logistical issue and feat. But how you transition a workforce, you can't just go replace them. I mean, it's thousands of people. And so we said we're going to have to retool and reskill an entire workforce. And it became a multifaceted project. And by the way, we're not finished. But we are well down the road. I'm starting to sleep at night, feeling like we may actually pull this off. And it took, we used a lot of technology to make this happen. And that was, and it's interesting how you start here. You start by creating awareness with your employees that there needs to be a change in your skills. And a lot of communication. But all of you have HR systems. And you have HR systems when a job opening comes up, people go and look at it, and you have a process where they can go apply for that job, right? It starts there. Job opening, person clicks on that job. First thing they see is, are the number of people doing this job over the last 3 years, has it been doing this or has it been doing this? And if it's been doing this, you see a mitigating interest in people wanting to move into those jobs. If it's doing this, you see high interest. I like this job. What's required to have this job? Here are the skill sets. It's very explicit. These are the skill sets you need. How do I get those skill sets? Here are the badges or the accreditations you need to earn. How do I get those badges or accreditations? You click here, you go, you complete this coursework, it's all online, and once you've completed it, you have your badges, you come in and you can apply for this job, and we move people into these new skills and these new jobs. Millions of these courses have been completed. Thousands upon thousands of these badges have been earned, and we're having a workforce just kind of morph very naturally into a new workforce that's being repurposed for a new functionality. And I this is probably, of all the things that I've been a part of as CEO, I'm watching this, and I probably take more satisfaction in this than anything I've been a part of. It's been really exciting to watch. And Tom Friedman, you know, writes the New York Times. He's come and he's challenged me. He said, you need to take this and you need to hand it to cities. This should be the workforce planning for cities and how you can actually begin to make sure you're matching skills and jobs in various communities around the country. I don't know if that's right or not. I'm doing some work in that area, but it's been interesting and fun to be a part of.
Well, it sounds like many of us could learn from that experience, because the scale you're working on is so tremendous with a
We're
number
happy
of people.
To share.
Yeah. So, okay. I'm sure there's some questions out here, and I think there's a few microphones that are floating around. There's a question right there.
I was nervous after the way I was introduced when he talked about curiosity overcomes formal education. I thought, oh, he knows I went to Oklahoma. And so I thought,
thank you. Gerald Chertavian, the founder and CEO of Year Up. Randall, you recently gave a speech that was, I thought, a courageous, bold, inspirational speech to several thousand of your employees around race, something you don't often see. I was curious to maybe share some of your learnings, perceptions, reflections on perhaps why you decided to do that, what you've learned as a CEO who's trying to build a pluralistic society that actually welcomes all talent, and to share with this group, particularly I think here in Boston, it's an issue where could use and appreciate any perspectives you could share.
Yeah, thank you. this was a speech made in the fall of 2016, and it was an internal organization, and as I've told people, it was intended to be a family talk. And you knew what was going on back at that point in time. You know, we had a lot of African-American men had been shot and killed by police two blocks from my office. I mean, literally a couple of weeks before this talk that he's referring to, five police officers had been killed in Dallas, just right down the street from our offices. And America was in a real state of turmoil. And people were asking a lot of questions. And with 275,000 people, we had our own people asking a lot of questions. You know, what's going on here? And you're starting to see a lot of contention, even among your employees. And I was taken that nobody in the U.S., I didn't see any of our leaders in the U.S. stepping up and bringing any context to what was going on, what was happening, and how should we be thinking about this and processing this and providing just some broader thought, at least, on it. And I, myself, was guilty as charged. And so I was getting ready to go speak to a group of our employees, a couple thousand people, and my best friend is African-American, and I had just serendipitously seen a talk he was asked to give where he talked about what he had experienced growing up as an African American in Louisiana. And I remember watching this going, oh my God, I never knew this about this guy. And he and I are really, really close, I mean, really tight. And I had no idea what he had experienced. And I suddenly started to see some of the issues with the police officers. By the way, I respect our police officers, but I started to view some of the people's views in this area through a different lens, through different eyes. And it changed my whole perception of this. And so I shared this with our employees. And I don't know if you know it, but these phones that we sell, they have cameras on them, video cameras. And so somebody captured this talk. And by the time I got home, my smartphone was blowing up his emails, and he'd posted this out on a YouTube site, and it went viral, and it ran hot for a long time. And I was getting barraged by emails and so forth, and they scanned the board, you know, from, you know, how dare you to thank you for speaking out. And it really, what it did was it empowered our people to go out and talk about this, all right? And my point was, I didn't know this about one of my best friends, and it changed me to learn this about him. We need to learn this about each other. We need to understand where everybody's coming from. And the quote at the end of it that I said is, I said, I'm not asking you to be tolerant. Tolerance is for cowards. You know, to be tolerant requires nothing from you other than just to passively sit back and not be challenged by your own thoughts and understandings. Go out and understand. And so within AT&T, it initiated a process where, I mean, it's been pervasive what's gone on in terms of the dialogue within AT&T, the openness of the dialogue, the candor of the dialogue. People are being a little bit vulnerable, and it's had an impact within AT&T. And I encourage people, if you haven't done something like this, to do it within your company.
Okay. We have another question?
Yes, Randy, Peter McAvin, New York Life.
Peter.
My question is, how much of the retooling of your workforce was retraining, and how much was hiring new people?
It's been overwhelmingly retraining. I mean, obviously, we hire a lot of people, and so over time, you know, you bring in new skill sets. But and by the way, our arithmetic, the logistical exercise I talked about, was what is going to be the natural attrition of the workforce. What is kind of the natural inflow you get from hiring new people? And then when you looked at that, how many do you still have to reskill? That number you had to reskill was just an overwhelming number. So it is, the lion's share is retooling and reskilling existing workforce. And you know, we did some other things here. You know, one of the things we all need are computer science trained people. And I don't know about you guys, but competing with Google and Facebook and so forth on this kind of talent is really, really hard. And so we said, how do we grow our own? And so we initiated an effort in this area with, you probably know Udacity, Sebastian Thrun, he and I have become very close, and Georgia Tech. And this was a lot of work. This was too much work. We have a public policy problem with what I'm about to describe here, and that is, we wanted to offer a master's of computer science program at a prestigious engineering school like Georgia Tech. But we wanted the price point to come way down because we wanted to pay for all of it. If our people wanted to go, we wanted to cover the cost of it. But at Georgia Tech, it's $41,000 to get that degree. It took us a couple years, a lot of work with the governor, a lot of work with the Board of Regents, a lot of work with the professionals inside of Georgia Tech. We finally got it done, and we're now offering our people, anybody who wants to go, a fully accredited master's of computer science degree from Georgia Tech, the same one you get if you go to campus and receive it, not $41,000, but for, I think it's now $6,700. And we pay for 100% of it. And so, but that 2 years, that's too hard, it takes too long. Technology is here to enable this type of capability, this type of broad distribution of the highest education capabilities we have in this country, and we got to figure out a way to make this go faster. But
thank
you bet.
Great. We have one more question in the audience. Yeah, back there. Can we get a mic to the back center of the room?
I may not need a microphone.
Okay.
I can hear you fine.
It was Slade talking about FirstNet.
How are you going to address that issue?
As you might guess, security. You're talking about just network security, I assume. But security is paramount on this. And in fact, if you were going to win the bid, you better have security, network security capabilities. And we all probably think this, but I'll say I think AT&T is the best when it comes to network security. I don't think anybody's as close to us. And we have the biggest brains in data science. We have algorithms that do detection of network anomalies. And we think we're really, really good at this. Obviously, the folks who selected us must have thought we had capabilities here as well. But security in general is everything in this world of networking. And we are investing millions of dollars in network security. And look, we have a vested interest in this. I continue to say the moment somebody thinks that doing a financial transaction on a smartphone or a tablet is not safe, the moment somebody thinks conducting commerce with a smartphone is not safe, then our business model is at risk. We have a strong, strong incentive to make sure we get this, the security aspects of this right. So we put a lot of time, energy, and money into it.
Yeah, right there with you.
Yeah, I know you are. You demand it of me.
Okay. I think we're, do we have time for one more question? One more, is there another question out there? Some mic floating away. Okay, I think we're finished. Thank you.
Thank you, Ellie.
We hope you enjoyed the podcast of the Boston College Chief Executives Club featuring Randall Stephenson, Chairman, CEO, and President of AT&T. To learn more about the Boston College Chief Executives Club, a program of the Carroll School of Management at Boston College, please visit www.bc.edu/CEO Club.